kind of called Heroes and Villains, or even Heroes, Villains and Victims. Why have I picked that? Well, that's a very common story. You think about the Marvel Universe, right? There's always, you know, there's usually a baddie and there's usually a poor defenseless victim, and then there's usually an amazing hero who kind of swoops in to save the day. And the story of their struggle and their ultimate triumph is a really compelling story. We should know. I think there must have been about, there's probably been about 35,000 Marvel films by now, so, you know, we're getting used to that. But it's big box. They make lots of them because it grabs us and it's compelling. So there's one thing that we know that has shown its power and effectiveness through the generations, through history, right since the days when people were, you know, lighting fires and sitting around. It's the power of story. It's the effectiveness of story. It grabs us, and we find ourselves, we see ourselves in the story. We're part of the story. And somehow we imagine, as we hear it, we kind of, yeah, we place ourselves in the story, and then that shapes their imagination. It captures us. It captures the way we think. Advertisers know this very well now. It used to be, like when I was younger, it used to be an advert would come on the telly and it would have features, you know, this thing does this and this and this. And it has these benefits, features and benefits. You're always taught that in sales, that's what you had to do. Whereas now, what happens is they show a kind of a story and you can connect with the story. And in that story happens to be their product, which might be a San Miguel beer or a nice coffee or some jeans to wear or an app or actually most recently, almost every time, fun times with friends placing sports bets. Apparently that's like the gateway to a great new world. Every time you go on the TVNZ app, it's telling you that. But there's something going on there that advertisers have latched onto. Again, this same thing of, If they can place us in a story, we respond to being in that story and it shapes the way we think about things. And that's pretty much what is true of life. Now, there was one person who really, really exemplified all of that. There's a guy called Solomon who was a ruler actually back in thousands of years ago. And he wrote a very helpful book about it called Ecclesiastes. It's in the Bible in the Old Testament. And he pursues all kinds of things in there. He grabs onto what's a story of the good life. You know, he pursues pleasure and happiness and good times. And then he kind of finds it a bit hollow. He pursues work and career and achievement. But then he uncovers that there's a lot of real rivalry and stuff going on behind the scenes. And it's all pretty impermanent anyway. He pursues wealth and possessions and status. But it just seems to evaporate like the morning mist. He pursues wisdom and academic excellence. But it's just elusive. And eventually he looks back pretty wistfully, actually, on a life. And he says, you know what? Remember your creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come. So he doesn't have a sense of a life well lived. He has a sense of having got caught up in the wrong kind of story and missed so much of the life he could have had. So it's a pretty salutary lesson about being caught up in stories that are not maybe the right story for us. It was Augustine that said, "You've made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." So this morning we're going to think a bit about the stories people tell us that capture our imagination, even as Christians, and what happens when they fall apart. So if you've got a Bible and you want to turn to it, we're going to read from the book of Luke, chapter 24. And this is called On the Road to Emmaus. So this is a point in the good news message that Luke tells when Jesus has, with his disciples, they've gone to Jerusalem and he's been crucified. He's been executed as a criminal and he's died and he's been buried and pretty much all of his followers have scattered. They're at their lowest ebb, and they don't really know what's going on at this point. So let's just read from Luke 24, verse 13. "Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked among them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, 'What are you discussing together as you walk along?' They stood still,
their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only person visiting Jerusalem who does not know that things have happened here in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they said. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was going to be the one who would redeem Israel. And what is more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but they didn't find his body. They came and told us they'd seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. And then some of our companions went to the tomb, and they found it just as the women said, but they didn't see Jesus." He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he was going further. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it's nearly evening. The day is almost over." He went in to stay with them. And when he was at the table with them, he took bread, he gave thanks and broke it and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" They got up, returned at once to Jerusalem. There they find the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, "It's true, the Lord has risen and appeared to Simon." Then these two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. If you could just close your eyes just for a second and imagine it's you on a walk for a couple of hours, maybe sort of from here to Mission Bay or somewhere. But a walk where you're reeling. 4 days ago, everything was normal. But since then, all your friends are scattered, and the person you rely on most in the world was taken from you. And your own leaders made it happen. He died a hideous, painful, shameful, grisly death. And now, just this morning, there are two people spouting some incoherent, ridiculous nonsense about him coming back to life, which you and everyone else have dismissed. But you haven't really had time to stop and think. It's all been happening so quickly until now. And now you're walking with your friend. You're thinking about all your hopes and your intentions for the future ahead that are now completely gone. You and your friend have 2 hours together as you journey. Feel free to open your eyes, but just the sense of the feeling of that. We often have the benefit of having read further forward in the story when we think about these things, but Cleopas didn't have that. Had no idea. Just had 4 days that had completely seen everything he thought was going to happen just turned to dust. And that's where he was, and that's all he could see. That's all both of them could see. The thing about a walk is it gives you time and you can mull things over. Now, sometimes that's helpful, isn't it? And sometimes it's more like worrying a mouth ulcer when something terrible's happened. You keep busy, but you're kind of turning it over and over in your mind. And particularly when you get a time, maybe with a walk is when it all catches up with you. See, I think they probably thought like their story was ending. The story that they thought was going to happen, it had come to an end. But unbeknown to them, they're going to have a story to tell of their own. The second thing I really notice about this passage is just the sense of the pain of disappointment. It just looks so sad. And when something terrible has happened to you, and I'm sure all of us have had this experience, it can be when someone asks you, they ask you about it, you have to put it into words. And when you have to put it into words again for somebody new, it just sort of really hits you. It hits you all over again, the bad thing that's happened. And it can be such a crushing feeling inside that you kind of, you can't breathe, and like a wave of grief just shows in your face as you try and get together and explain. And that's what I imagine was happening when this unknown stranger said, what's been going on? And they had to retell it, but in the retelling it, they reconnected with it. And it was so painful, you could see it on their faces. And even more, that it was not just this terrible thing had happened, but it happened at the instigation of their leaders. You know, their national leaders had instigated this thing, this terrible thing. It's a lot harder to take when people you most trust and respect to those who you feel let down by. And it's really nice not to go through those things alone. But sometimes when you're trying to make friend with a close, trying to make sense of things with a friend who's right there with you in it, you can feel as lost as each other. And actually you might need somebody who's just can bring you a fresh perspective that's from outside, because when you're in the middle of it, it's really hard to find hope and it's really hard to see your way through. So what do we learn from what Jesus did and what he didn't do? Well, he walked with them for a while and he listened carefully. You know, asking questions is listening. Now, you might say, I don't think Jesus was a very good pastor at this point. You might say that. You know, didn't put his arm around them. Didn't even reveal himself to them. They didn't have a sense of God's presence with them. So he wasn't very pastoral by our standards. But our greatest need when our world is falling apart is, we might think it's a human caring touch, and that really does matter, but it's not our greatest need. We might even think our greatest need is to have a sense of God's presence with us when it all falls apart. But this shows us that even that's not our greatest need. What Jesus actually did shows the greatest need when the story that you felt yourself a part of turns out not to be all that it was cracked up to be. Because you see, for them, despite everything Jesus had done to show that he would be different, in their mind, they were connecting back to a story that was their generation's story. They believed that the Messiah would be riding in on a stallion, he'd be a strong figure, and he would take it to the Romans. He would defeat their enemies. And that's how they would get to the good life, rather than being a people who are occupied. They had a kind of military, political view of what might happen. And this Jesus, although it was amazing, well, they kind of thought maybe he's going to be the great king that leads us to victory. So, a bit like our Marvel story, you know, they were occupied territory, victims, awaiting a hero, the Messiah, to beat the villains, the Romans. And the thing is, the stories we tell ourselves, they're a bit like a camera. When you put the old-fashioned cameras, when you put something into focus, you focus on a certain point, everything else around it goes fuzzy. So for them, their focus was the victory of strength over their adversaries. And everything else that Jesus told them was kind of just fuzzy. So they didn't really hear it. So that was the thing that Jesus needed to do for them most of all, was to say, you need to see that the story you've thought yourself part of is not God's story. It's not my story. It's come to an end and you're desolate because it's not my story. And it says, beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them all that was said in the scriptures concerning himself. This wasn't like a kind of 5-minute devotional, you know. It probably took quite a lot of those 2 hours. But what he was saying to them was this: the story that you're living, it's not your story. It's not your story. Someone else has told it to you, and you've accepted it, and you've imagined yourself in it. But that story puts you and everyone else in the wrong place. There's a bigger story. There's a greater story. There's a more eternal story that is waiting to capture you. You're not the hero. You're not the villain. You're not the victim.
It's a compelling tale, but it's not our story. We have to drop the world's stories of heroes and villains. God has a different story. It's God's story of one who came not on the stallion, on the charger, but came humble riding a donkey. A different kind of story to connect with. And this is, I imagine this is the kind of thing that Jesus will have been opening up for them from the scriptures. In Isaiah, talking about the Messiah coming, it says, he grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. But surely he took up our infirmities. He carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. You see what's being revealed there? That even that sense of we want oppression from all the things without us that would trouble us, all the circumstances, the hard times that came from being under Roman occupation. We want liberation from the circumstances that don't work for us in our lives that we feel oppress us. But actually, God has a bigger story. The bigger story is actually the things that we've done that separate us from him. And that God would let Jesus be pierced. He was pierced in his side by the spear of a Roman centurion to check that he'd given his life, that he was dead, after he'd been executed. And thousands of years before, Isaiah prophesied, he foresaw that that was what was going to happen. And that was what Jesus opened. I think that's what Jesus opened their eyes to. There's a different story. And that different story doesn't just deal with your external circumstances, the Romans. It deals with the heart of the matter, which is the problem of our hearts, that our hearts are inclined to go away and do our own thing. Our hearts are inclined to turn away from God and just live for ourselves. And actually, we need somebody to be a savior. We need someone to pay the price for the wrong things that we've done so we don't bear that burden anymore. And that's the Messiah that was coming, the different story. Lots of things happen when we let go of our old story and embrace being part of God's story. Five things. It releases us from the pressure of being a hero. It frees us from disqualification when we mess up. It magnifies the grace of God and our dependence on him. It helps us see God at work in unexpected places. And it lights up hope in the darkest times. Let's have a look at that. So it frees us from the pressure and unrealistic self-expectation of being the hero. Do you try to be the hero in your life? And of course, we all step up, we all take action, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, Spider-Man with great power comes with great responsibility and all that. Sense of calling and destiny. But you see, in contrast to all those heroes that we read in the comic books, the final outcome does not all depend on us. It doesn't all depend on you. If you're trying to be the hero in your life, if you've got an exaggerated sense that it all depends on you, you can be freed from that with the better story. None of us are the perfect parent. None of us are the perfect spouse. None of us are the perfect worker. None of us are the perfect ally. We all grapple with personal failure and self-doubt. Reminds me a bit of Elijah in the cave. After the showdown, he kind of, I feel like I'm the only one left. God, I can't do it. I can't be the hero. And then God says, finally, now I can use you. So we can be freed from the pressure and this unrealistic self-expectation of being the hero. And the flip side is being released from the sense of disqualification when we blow it and reveal our true fallen nature.
John said, didn't he, I write to you this, that you will not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. We shouldn't expect to sin. But some of our disappointment is that we deceive ourselves into thinking that we're really basically good people. We thought we were the hero, but the enemy says, you see, now you're the villain, you're the part of the problem. But ultimately, as we see right through the Bible, God is the only hero. You know, Abraham lied about Sarah. Lot offered his daughters to the mob. Jacob cheated his way through life. David was cheating on and murdering his most loyal soldier. Peter was denying he'd ever knew Jesus, and Paul was falling out with Barnabas about Mark. We are flawed and we are fallen, but he, God, is the hero. So we're not disqualified despite that. Thirdly, it magnifies the grace of God to us. Not do I believe I can do it, but do I believe in him, success or failure? Our own fear of failure can be the most challenging thing. The reality is we need not to place ourselves as a hero on mission nor the villain. We're the redeemed. We're objects of grace. So don't believe the hype and don't believe the lies. We will be a frail and faltering part of a remarkable story that has but one hero. We're not the A-team. We're a ragtag army. We're the unlikely victors who sided with the most powerful ally. Now, often when things are going well, things, you know, we're living our story, we're not even aware that we've imbibed a different story, a lesser story in our lives. We're identifying with it. And certainly for me, these last sort of few weeks of being out of work for the last sort of 3 months, you know, seeing the money run out, there's a sort of a bit of me that thinks, yeah, I have this view of life that is, you know, God is the provider. And on the other hand, I have a view of life that, you know, I grew up with of, I saw all around me of, you know, in the 1980s, survival of the fittest, you know, a sense of never quite doing enough. Will God provide for me? It tapped into deep stuff, actually. You know, I graduated. When I graduated, it was the middle of the recession and there were no jobs. The graduate schemes were all cancelled. I was like, and there were loads of people who owed more money on their houses than the value of their house. So the banks just called it in and put them out and they were homeless. People who'd got big mortgages in the hopes of a good time and it all came crashing down. And just even these last few weeks, I realized that that thing that happened back, you know, 40 years ago, is kind of in there. There's just that a sense of, you know, maybe there's a story that I was leading into that you work hard and you get to be secure financially. And so the thing that happened that where the circumstance was difficult suddenly revealed things in my heart that frankly I thought, I've dealt with that, but no. If we can get back to the true story, we understand we're so dependent on him for everything, for victory, but we can rely on him. And it frees us from looking, therefore, just to strong and talented people to notice grace in unexpected places. You know, there are no unlikely people to suddenly find Jesus and be saved. You might think of people you know who feel pretty hostile towards the things of God. And this story they might think is not at all for them. And yet, God finds faith in unexpected places. When Jesus spoke to, when Jesus said, I've not found faith like this anywhere, he was talking about the faith of an occupying force commander. It's really surprising what is going on in people that we might rule out. Because that bigger story has a power that is beyond what we can realize. And fifthly then, it lights up hope in the darkest of times. There was a man named Janimus Comenius who lived 400 years ago. He was part of a network of churches, probably a bit like ours, in a place called Moravia in Eastern Europe. But it was a time of real persecution. He's actually very well known. He's, if you look at Wikipedia, you'll say he's considered to be the father of modern education. He's one of the really first champions that everybody should be educated. If you've got pictures in your textbook, that's because of Comenius. That was something that he did. If you've been part of a nursery, primary school, high school, college, university progression, that was him as well. So he's a pretty famous guy. Wikipedia, he compiled the first one of those. And he was kind of like I say this for the people who are part of our church, he was kind of like the John Wimber of his church movement. So he was a pretty central figure. in what was going on. And he was sure that the church he was part of, this thriving underground church, was a fulfillment of a prophecy that had been made about 200 years before, that there was a kind of hidden seed that would emerge. And you know what happened to him? It sounds like the startings of an amazing success and an amazing life. Well, the religious state authorities burned down decades of his life work. They burned down all of his libraries. He lost his wife and he lost his children. And at the end, he fled out of the Czech Republic, what is now the Czech Republic, into exile in Poland. And a whole stream of churches from his nation were completely gone. The nation he'd loved and served, it was all gone. Loss and harm is real. We grieve for it. It's not like we're kind of Buddhists who disengage and avoid pain. Yet in the worst of times, when all seemed gone, this is what he said. If the blood of the martyrs and also our blood shall be seed, let us weeping scatter the precious seed, that we may bring the sheaves in with rejoicing. He knows what he is doing. He does not do these things for no purpose. Something great lies hidden under it all. Now, 94 years later, a young nobleman heard the call of God and began giving asylum on his land to some of those Moravian believers who were refugees. A guy called Nicholas Zinzendorf. They set up small groups, a bit like our G3s. They began to see signs and wonders, healings. About 24 of them each decided to pray for a different hour of the day. And a 100-year cycle of continuous prayer began. And the Moravian church sent missionaries into all corners of the world, the most fruitful missional churches in history. And it was two young Moravian missionaries whose faith in doing the menial task without complaining and singing worship songs when all around were in terror on a ship, at the ship's mast breaking in a storm, that shocked a young man called John Wesley. He sought out another Moravian, a preacher, who explained the gospel to him. And he went on to lead the most amazing revival right across England. A revival, by the way, that led to William Wilberforce, who Wesley mentored, taking aside those who were going to be coming to a place called New Zealand and talking to them about the importance of having a treaty so that the people who were already part of that land would not end up being oppressed by commercial interests. So actually, he's connected with our story and the story of our nation. Now, of course, few of us are going to experience a kind of devastation that Comenius did, where everything seems lost. And yet, look at what God was doing. Something hidden was underneath it all. God has always been the God of the walk. He walked with Adam and Eve in the cool of the evening. He walked with Enoch. He walked with Abraham and talked to him about Sodom. He walked with the 12 through Galilee and Samaria. And as we've seen today, he walked with Cleopas and his friend to Emmaus. So we're at the point now where we just want to respond to this. And I wonder, where are you on the walk this morning? Are you at the place at the start of the walk? In fact, are you at the place where they were even before the start of the walk, where everything was going okay? But actually, you didn't realize you weren't fully focused on God's story, that you were going with another story. Or are you at the start of the walk where everything has just seemed to have fallen apart a bit and you're trying to make sense and struggling with disappointment? Maybe you're at that middle of the journey where God is just changing your thinking. Even this morning, he's helping you to see there's a different story. And it's his story and it's time to change channel. Maybe you realize that you've been painted into a role by accepting the story other people have put on you. Well, be free of that today. You can give up on being the hero or the villain or the victim. Or are you like they were coming to the end of the walk? You've got that fresh perspective. And the question is, the stranger is going to carry on. And what we read about was they said, you know what? No, stay with us. come spend time with us. And then they really encountered Jesus by doing that. So if God's at work, maybe just this morning in your heart, figure out what is it that you need to do to respond to him? How do you respond to a new story? Do you say to him, please come spend more time with me. Come and be with me for a bit. I want to hear more. I want to understand more about this different story. Sounds like I want to be part of that story.